the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak, Dan Friedel, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Americans do not believe their personal information is safe online, suggests findings from a new poll. They also are not satisfied with the federal government's efforts to protect such information.
The Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, and Meritalk did the polling.
It found that 64% of Americans say their social media activity is not secure. About as many have the same safety concerns about online information that shares their physical location. Half of Americans also believe their private text messages are not secure. They are not just concerned. They want the federal government to do something about it.
Almost 75% of Americans say they support creating laws for how companies can collect, use, and share personal data. Jennifer Benz is the head of the AP NORC Center.
What is surprising to me is that there is a great deal of support for more government action to protect data privacy, she said. But after years of failed efforts to create stronger data privacy laws, Americans do not trust the government to fix the problem. A majority of those who took part in the poll said they have more trust in private companies than the federal government to address security and privacy issues. This comes even after years of hacks of U.S. corporations that shared the personal information of millions of people around the world. I feel there is little to no security whatsoever, said Sarah Blick. She is a professor at Kenyon College in Ohio. Officials at the college told Blick earlier this year that someone had used her identity to seek unemployment insurance money. Such fraud has greatly increased since the pandemic began. The poll answers showed that about 71% of Americans believe that individuals' data privacy should be treated as a national security issue. But only 23% are satisfied in the federal government's current efforts. Terry Carver is a Republican Party state lawmaker in Colorado and the writer of a data privacy bill that will take effect there in 2023. The law follows similar measures passed in California and Virginia and gives people the right to find and delete personal information. Colorado's law also permits people to opt out of having their data tracked and sold. Facebook and other companies opposed the bill. There's great frustration that individuals have that they don't have the tools and the legal support to establish any kind of effective control over their personal data, Carver said. She hopes the efforts by Colorado and other states push Congress to make national protections. The poll showed that protecting personal information online is an area where people do see a direct role in government, Ben said. I'm Dan Novak.
U.S. President Joe Biden announced new rules on September 9th that require certain people to get a COVID-19 vaccination. One part of the announcement said businesses that employ 100 people or more must ask their employees to get vaccinated or require them to show a negative virus test once per week. The rules will affect about 100 million Americans. However, Biden also said people may choose not to be vaccinated due to their religious beliefs. This is known as a religious exemption. In the days following Biden's announcement, many people began claiming that religious exemption. In Los Angeles, about 2,600 police department employees are claiming the exemption. In the state of Washington, in America's Northwest, thousands of people who work for the state government are also claiming the exemption. In Arkansas, so many employees of a hospital are claiming the exemption that the hospital says they are bluffing. In the past, not many people used religious beliefs as a reason to avoid vaccinations. But the COVID-19 pandemic is different. Even though the vaccines are safe, protective, and widely available in the U.S., many people do not want to get them. Now, people are claiming the religious exemption. Many religious leaders do not object to the vaccines. There has been some concern, however, over the cell line used by the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The Janssen vaccine uses cells grown in a lab that came from a fetus in 1985, Johnson & Johnson has said repeatedly there is no fetal tissue in its vaccine. The Catholic Church said it is morally acceptable for Catholics to receive vaccines that come from fetal cell research. Pope Francis said not getting a vaccine would be suicide. He received the vaccine made by Pfizer-BioNTech. The White House said it understands many people may use religion as a reason to refuse the vaccine. However, it argues, if the new rule makes more people say yes, it will save lives. In the first part of September, about 1,000 people died each day in the United States from COVID-19. In Los Angeles, Mayor Eric Garcetti said, "We will not tolerate the abuse of these exemptions by those who simply don't want to get vaccinated. People who work for the city must be vaccinated by October 5th. A group of police employees who do not want the vaccine is taking legal action. In the state of Washington, Governor Jay Inslee said state employees may lose their jobs if they are not vaccinated by October 18th, unless they receive an exemption. However, receiving an exemption does not guarantee people will stay employed. The state will decide if people who are not vaccinated can still do their job without putting others at risk. Other large employers in the U.S., including United Airlines, said people who get an exemption will not be permitted to work until new COVID-19 testing plans are put into effect. I'm Dan Friedel.
Imagine you are discussing your day. Perhaps you want to describe your morning, what you did, how you felt, and so on. Morning is a time of action. You wake up, you drink something, you plan your day. Verbs describe such actions. In today's everyday grammar, you will learn about how to use different kinds of verbs to talk about the morning. You will learn about phrasal verbs, linking verbs, and an important verb and noun phrase structure. Phrasal verbs are groups of words that have a meaning that differs from what the individual words suggest. Phrasal verbs have a verb and another short word or words. Phrasal verbs play an important part in describing mornings. Let's consider an example. Wake up. You might hear a sleepy person say,
I woke up at 11 a.m. I was supposed to be at work at 9.
In the example, you heard the past tense form of wake up, woke up. Waking up is the first action of every person's day. And usually, after you wake up, you do another action that involves a phrasal verb, get up. Get up means to rise or to cause another person to rise after sleeping. Many parents have told their children, get up, it's time for school. Get up is close in meaning to yet another phrasal verb, get out of, as in, get out of bed. After waking up and getting up, or getting out of bed, you might consider how you are feeling. At this point, we move from phrasal verbs to linking verbs. Linking verbs are verbs that connect the subject to a word or words that give more information about the subject. They are different from other kinds of verbs because they don't really describe actions. Instead, they describe feelings and states of being. One of the most common linking verbs is the verb be. A person that just woke up might say, I am tired, or I am sleepy. In both of these cases, the verb be connects the subject, I, to an adjective, such as tired or sleepy. These are qualities or states of being. People who have just woken up might also use adjectives like hungry or thirsty. But be is not the only linking verb you might use to describe how you feel in the morning. You can also use the verb feel. A person might say, I feel sleepy, or I feel energetic. After considering how you feel, you might take action. The verb make is important for describing actions in the morning. Make often appears with a noun phrase, a group of words that acts like a noun in a sentence. So, for example, a person might say,
"After I wake up, I always make my bed."
In the example, the noun phrase "my bed" comes after the verb "make." But people don't just make their beds in the mornings. They make coffee, they make tea, or they make breakfast. In today's report, you learned about how different verb forms or structures help describe the morning and the morning's activities. Try to use some of what you have learned today when you are speaking English in class or with friends. Pay careful attention to movies or shows. You might hear some of the verbs we just talked about today. You might learn about some other verb structures, too. We hope that the next time you wake up, you will say to yourself, "I am excited to learn more about English grammar." I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the Amistad case. The Amistad was a slave ship from Cuba. In 1839, it appeared off the eastern coast of the United States. The Africans on the ship had killed white crew members, including the captain. They demanded to go back home to Africa. But the two remaining slave traders on the ship secretly sailed the Amistad toward the United States. The U.S. government put the Africans in a low-security prison in New Haven, Connecticut, and it made plans to take the Africans to court. A judge would decide whether the occupants of the ship were slaves who had rebelled, murderers, or captives who had been kidnapped from their homes. The Amistad case brought attention once again to the issue of slavery in the United States. At the time, slavery was legal and an important part of the country's economy. But the U.S. and several European countries had banned the international slave trade. A small group of activists wanted to totally end slavery. They believed slavery was a sin. But in the 1830s, most Americans did not support these anti-slavery activists known as abolitionists.
Most Americans, first of all, were racist, and secondly, saw these people as utter fanatics who were intent on destroying the Union.
Julie Roy Jeffrey is a professor of history at Goucher College in Maryland. She says newspapers reported on the Amistad case, and people began talking about slavery and the slave trade. Slowly, some Americans' feelings toward the abolitionist movement and enslaved Africans changed.
For example, there was a play put on in New York City called The Black Schooner that was based on the Amistad incident. And there were many, many people who went to see it. It became a popular event. And wax figures of the captives were exhibited in various places in the United States, and artists drew pictures of them.
The abolitionists wanted to make more Americans sympathetic to the Amistad Africans. They found lawyers to represent them, paid tutors to teach them, and organized outdoor exercises to keep them healthy and visible. Howard Jones taught history at the University of Virginia. He says one of the most popular members of the Amistad Africans was an 8-year-old boy who had learned English. The boy told the public about his life in Africa and about the conditions on the slave ship that brought him across the Atlantic Ocean. The Amistad case also was increasingly becoming a political issue. People wanted to know what President Martin Van Buren was going to do about the case. Historian Howard Jones says Van Buren found the position difficult. He did not want to anger Southern voters who supported slavery and wanted to make the African slave trade legal again. He also did not want to anger Northern voters who believed the Amistad Africans had been mistreated.
Van Buren did what any good politician would do, and that was to try to dodge the issue, stay away from it. He couldn't understand why 40-plus, by this time, black people should affect anything happening in high political society.
But the Amistad issue would not go away. The case began in a circuit court. After 3 days, it went to a district court. The district court judge ruled that the African slave trade was illegal under international treaties. For that reason, the Africans were wrongly taken. President Van Buren was worried the decision would cause more political problems for him, so he ordered the nation's highest court, the Supreme Court, to hear the case. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at that time was Joseph Story. Story did not like slavery, but he did not support the abolitionist movement either. He thought its ideas opposed the rule of law. The abolitionists had good lawyers, but they knew they needed more help arguing their case in the Supreme Court. So they turned to former President John Quincy Adams. At the time, Adams was a congressman, not an abolitionist. But he led a campaign against an 1836 rule restricting anti-slavery petitions. Adams said the rule was a violation of the constitutional right to petition Congress. Historian Julie Jeffrey says the 1836 gag rule, as it was called, helped the abolitionists' cause.
It became partly a freedom of speech issue, not just about slavery, but about the rights of citizens to speak out and to be heard by their representatives in Congress.
Yet John Quincy Adams was not excited about arguing the Amistad case. He was 72 years old, nearly blind, and very busy. But the issue of the Amistad Africans troubled him. Howard Jones says Adams believed capturing people and enslaving them was immoral, especially in a country like the United States. In the end, Adams agreed to defend the Africans.
And he makes the argument in the court case that we have the Declaration of Independence right there on that wall, and that says that life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, it doesn't say for white people only or anything like it. He was trying to argue that it's something that's available for everyone. It's part of the justice system.
Chief Justice Joseph Story did not totally accept Adams' argument or suggest that any kind of slavery was wrong, but he did agree with the district court that these Africans had been taken illegally from their homes. They were not and had never been slaves, Justice Story said. They were free people and should be returned home. So in 1841, the remaining 30 or so members of the Amistad captives got on a ship called the Gentleman and returned to West Africa. Howard Jones says the incident was the only time he knows that black people who had been brought to the New World as slaves actually made it back home.
And how they do it? By winning in the American court system. This was just unheard of. But the decision was basically that it doesn't matter whether you are black, white, purple, green, or whatever color you are, you have been kidnapped. And so therefore you have, and Joseph Story said this in his decision, which really opened the door for a lot of arguments, that under the eternal principles of justice, you have the inherent right of self-defense, even if you must kill your captors.
Howard Jones says the Supreme Court decision also gave the abolitionists a new sense of power.
And the abolitionists immediately printed pamphlets, leaflets, had talks, everything they could to show that these people went free. And their implication was, this is what's going to happen to slavery itself, that this is a great victory for the black man.
But the Amistad case did not really change the situation in the United States for most black people. Many were the children of slaves and could not argue that they had been kidnapped from Africa. And it was still legal to trade slaves across U.S. state borders. The Amistad case also did not solve all the problems in the abolitionist movement. Julie Roy Jeffries says during the trials, many abolitionists worked together, including blacks and whites.
It sometimes worked very well, and it sometimes didn't work so well, but it was certainly one of the first times that blacks and whites had worked so fruitfully together.
After the Amistad victory, though, the abolitionist movement broke into different groups. Ms. Jeffrey says some black abolitionists wanted more respect from white activists. Other abolitionists just had different ideas about how best to end slavery, by trying to change the country's laws or by appealing to Americans' moral sense of right and wrong. Abolitionism did influence other movements, however. One was the missionary movement. Julie Roy Jeffrey says Christian missionaries had already been going to Africa, hoping to persuade people to follow their religion. But the Amistad case and abolitionism made more people want to share their beliefs with others. Some missionaries even converted the Amistad captives to Christianity and returned to West Africa with them. Ms. Jeffrey says the abolitionist movement also helped create the women's movement in the middle of the 1800s. She says most 19th century white women mainly cared for their families in the home, but women abolitionists played an important public role.
They weighed in on the most political question of the day. They took on activities like collecting petition signatures and raising money and giving speeches.
As a result, Ms. Jeffrey says, some women came to believe they had a right to develop their own beliefs and have political power.
Sometimes they propped up their activism by appealing to things like the Bible. One woman I remember said something like, I read my Bible and I know what it tells me. And she was opposing the minister in her church, and she was a very active abolitionist.
Yet, even if abolitionism still did not personally affect most Americans, it made an increasing number of people question whether they wanted slavery to continue. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.